Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Students in the Digital Shoreline. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Scott Jasek.
Hello, I'm Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to today's audio conference on Students in the Digital Shoreline. Technology has changed the student experience in so many ways, from the way they look for colleges, to the way they perform administrative and other tasks, to how they learn, to how they file their papers, to how they consider whether they're having a good college experience. Our guest today is Professor Roger McCaney of Kansas State University, author of The New Digital Shoreline, which reviews all of these issues and many more. In the first half hour, Roger will walk us through the presentation you should have all received. If any of you did not, please email me at info@insidehighered.com, and I'll get you a copy right away. Toward the end of the presentation, we'll tell you how you can ask questions, and then we'll move to the Q&A. Roger, welcome.
Good afternoon. As Scott said, I'm Professor Roger McCaney from Kansas State University, and I've been there about 16 years now where I teach management information systems. And for those of you who are from outside the business disciplines, my academic area can kind of be defined as applying technology solutions to business problems. Originally, I developed and researched computer simulations in the auto industry, and that was back in the 1980s. And over the years, I've kind of progressed into researching ways that Web 2.0 and tech-savvy millennials are now impacting higher ed. As we go along, I'll kind of give you prompts on which slides that I'm covering, and we'll just kind of go from there. But on, if you turn to slide 2 now, you'll see that today's talk is going to be based on material that I've collected starting back in 2005 when I was K-State's Kauffman Chair for University Distinguished Teaching Scholars. Over the last few years, I've compiled this information into the Digital Shoreline book and tried to put together a series of informational vignettes, I guess, that give us a look at what the students are doing in higher ed and how that should be impacting and is impacting the way we teach our courses. A lot of the material was written up in Upper Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and I did a lot of that material on my summers there during a family retreat on the shore of Lake Huron. And as you might guess, the term family retreat implies that I have children, and yes, they are partly responsible for my interest in this particular topic, and their expectations for higher ed has greatly influenced a lot of my research. Being on the shore of Lake Huron also kind of gave a little bit of rise to the title of this book, The Digital Shoreline, because those two things kind of came together and gave me some ideas of how we are actually repopulating kind of a new area in higher ed right now. So to kind of get things kicked off, I want to tell you about one evening when I observed my daughter, who's a high school senior now, doing some homework for school. And this is kind of what I observed. So if you change to slide 3, my daughter Megan, face bathed in a bluish glow, sits at a computer with earbuds connecting her to a Microsoft Zune. An ice cube slowly melts in a glass next to her. The faint rhythm of Keisha is just audible over the annoying voice track coming from a Fred video streaming from YouTube. At the same time, a dozen Facebook chat windows chirp out their messages and clamor for position on the screen. Although its window is minimized at the moment, data is downloading from Microsoft's music website into the computer's media library. Text from last night is also running, as is her Flickr account, and although it seems she isn't paying attention to them, every now and again her fingers brush the keyboard to send a few snippets of text to her friends. Across the room, her television is tuned to a home improvement show, and at her feet, her pug Otis sits patiently. A second passes, and after typing something into her BlackBerry, she pulls out an earbud and sticks the phone against her head. A new introduction to pre-calc window flashes on the computer screen, and a definition of rays takes center stage. She pauses for a moment, then impatiently asks, "How am I supposed to know what a ray is?" Then she gives me a stare that says, "You're intruding into my world." I back off and let her continue with her homework. She's an A student, she's a tech-savvy millennial, and I'm not about to unplug her. Slide 4. In the spring of 2007, I was honored to be invited as K-State's College of Business commencement ceremony speaker. At that time, I wanted to convey a sense of each student's accomplishments, but also provide them with something to reflect on as they start the next leg of their life's journey. I began the address by moving out from the podium and peering at them intently through a small set of binoculars. I told them I needed to check my facts before starting my speech. It was interesting as I looked out at the class of students kind of closely. Some were bewildered, some were bored, others amused, and several rolled their eyes with that same blurry look I got from my daughter that evening. Some of the other ones kind of gave me a little bit of a get the crazy guy off the stage look, too. After a moment, I remarked to the dean that this was a pretty fine-looking group, but they weren't significantly different in appearance from many of the others I'd seen during my tenure at K-State. So that brings up the question, why should higher ed pay special attention to this complex mix of millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers, and their aptitudes, attitudes, and perspectives? Well, that's pretty obvious to most of us, I think. You know, they're the people sitting in our classrooms, they're hearing our lectures, they're filling out our teaching evaluations, and ultimately, in some regard, they're paying our salaries. Secondly, technologically savvy individuals are going to increasingly become our colleagues and are going to bring their unique perspectives, new skills, and new ideas into higher ed. As colleagues, their toolkits or social network-enabled work habits and their expectations are going to be dramatically different than anything we're seeing right now. And so whether you believe a generation of digital natives is emerging or not, and that term, of course, has gotten quite a bit of criticism lately, our youngest constituents have grown up in different times, and perhaps it's good to start viewing them as early adopters and in a few other ways. Slide number 5. Students as early adopters share several common characteristics. They're willing to embrace new technologies and ideas because they don't have much to lose. For example, if you work in an organization, a business organization, you've invested time, training, and expensive resources on a new information system, you're less likely to investigate alternatives and jump to new technologies. You don't want to give up the investment and time and effort you've put into that. The tech-savvy millennial, on the other hand, has the potential to be the ultimate early adopter of most technology advances. They're in the formative stages of becoming an adult. They haven't invested much money in what they're using for technology, and their ideas have not really formulated or are not being used in any kind of formal sense. So the technologies that they're experimenting with are also the same technologies that help them communicate and spread the words to their friends. So these things can kind of couple and combine to make the millennial a natural and supercharged early adopter. Slide number 6. I recently received a completed assignment via email from one of my university students. As a way to warm up my introductory technology class and engage their interests, I assigned them a relatively simple business blogging project. I asked them to create a blog on a topic of personal interest. Of course, I generally receive a lot of submissions that revolve around beer, favorite sports teams, student clubs, hobbies, pets, and things like that. But this time I got something very unique. I got a blog that was selling poetry to users of the World of Warcraft game. What struck me immediately about this submission was, first of all, I had no idea who completed it. This wasn't a student forgetting to put his or her name on the research paper. This person had a clear identity, and I'm calling them Orc Chick, which is changed to protect their identity here, if any of you are World of Warcraft players. And she said something like this in her author profile. If you change to slide 7. She said, "I began playing World of Warcraft 4 years ago. I've logged countless hours as a rogue and as the very lovely Orc Chick." Her profile went on and on with a number of other pieces of personal information. And at the time, I kind of looked at this and started asking myself, you know, this is pretty significant, but why? Well, first of all, here's a business student, keep that in quotes, a business student writing poetry for fun. When have you seen that happen before, right? And then take another moment to think about, she developed this poetry for amusement, and it's something that's valued by her peers. And on top of that, she clearly alluded that she had multiple identities in this online world. So we have a number of different factors at work here. Slide number 8. Recently, I've been speaking with groups of high school students all across Kansas as part of the presidential lecture series. And after each lecture, I have the opportunity to interact with students and collect their opinions regarding various aspects of being a tech-savvy millennial. What I've discovered, and not unexpectedly and actually consistent with what Orc Chick told me, is that most have a dichotomous existence, and that's over 80%, or most have multiple identities. Typical high school students have profiles on Facebook. Some have two profiles on Facebook, one that their parents belong to and one that they don't. Other students have multiple identities and multiple different kinds of online social networking services. So the tech-savvy millennials' friends kind of keep them somewhat honest about who they are by their picture, comments, and profile policing, I guess you would say. And by allowing people to tag pictures with names, identities, and so forth, their reality in the physical world can be verified to some extent. Generally, what I discovered is that a tech-savvy millennial's public persona is an intersection between their digital representation and the physical reality. And the more likely they are to meet people that they're interacting with in the physical world, the more realistic their identity seems to be online. So a totally anonymous identity allows them to explore potentially embarrassing situations without being exposed to the people who are around them in their day-to-day lives. Slide number 9, time shifters. Another hallmark of the tech-savvy millennial is time shifting. This became very apparent to me recently in a discussion with Kevin Stocks, who's an accounting professor at BYU. He recounted how learning has changed in the past few years, and particularly student expectations and their time management habits. He told me how several distance learning students once paid a visit to a professor friend of his, and these students had previously only interacted with him online through digital lectures. The first thing that they noted and told him was that his voice sounded really different, and I wondered about this until he said that the technology the students were using allowed them to play the lectures at a faster rate. And the students often used that feature to speed through the lectures in maybe a half or third the time. So until that day, when they encountered this professor, they generally heard him talking in a squeaky Mickey Mouse voice. So it was a little bit of a different situation. Slide 10. The tech-savvy millennial has a different sense of time than most previous generations. TiVo and other video recording services have allowed them to digitally capture television broadcasts and post the results on peer-to-peer networks like BitTorrent. Many TV shows even end up on video sharing sites like YouTube and Hulu, and hopefully some of our lectures end up there from time to time as well. So what are the long-term ramifications of time shifting? Well, some people are starting to say it may be rewiring the tech-savvy millennials' brains. The ability to instantly obtain digital content, including music, photos, movies, artwork, documents, assignments, books, and I could go on and on with this list, all these things have altered the expectations of the current student generation. In fact, it's even changed what they think is normal. Slide number 11. The same phenomenon has become kind of true in the digital classroom. If I don't send a response to an email quickly, I may get a follow-up message. In fact, some students experience what I like to call email lag anxiety. And sometimes I get as many as 10 emails in an hour from the same person wondering why I haven't responded to their initial inquiry. I know that sounds a little extreme, and it probably isn't the normal case, but it does reveal that some tech-savvy millennials now see email as old-fashioned and slow, and some of them kind of ignore it altogether. Slide number 12. The tech-savvy millennial is hit from all sides with information of all sorts. They're experiencing audio, video, text, pictures, multimedia, all kinds of things. Former Microsoft executive Linda Stone described their coping mechanism as continuous partial attention. She says on her blog that continuous partial attention describes how many of us use our attention today. It's different from multitasking. The two are differentiated by the impulse that motivates them. When we multitask, we are motivated by a desire to be more productive and more efficient. We're often doing things that are automatic that require little cognitive processing. We give the same priority to much of what we do when we multitask. We file and copy papers, we talk on the phone, we eat lunch, and we get as many things done at one time as we possibly can in order to be more efficient. To pay continuous partial attention is to pay partial attention continuously. It's motivated by a desire to be a live node on a network. We pay continuous partial attention in an effort not to miss anything. So what Stone is really saying is that she believes tech-savvy millennials have become information monitoring specialists and really can kind of be considered connected nodes on the web. And I've noticed this phenomenon with my students. They're continually receiving messages on their mobile devices. Maybe that does sound a little bit familiar to some of you right now. In fact, are any of you checking your email at the moment? And probably a few of you are texting. I like to ask that question to my students in classes sometimes, and I do find out that many of them have sent a text message out in the last couple minutes, even though I didn't see any of them holding or using their cell phone. So continuous partial attention is what Stone thinks is a temporary fix that prevents short-term information overload, but it does little for the long-term ability to control one's accessibility and the demands for attention. So recognition for this situation allows us teachers to provide tools and techniques that can help mitigate the situation. We might be able to pre-filter and organize material for students and help them have a little bit greater success in this type of thing. Remember, their world's moving from memorization to connecting, searching, and filtering. The tech-savvy millennial allows the machine, meaning the internet by this and the web, to remember and expects to be able to access and apply this information that they know is out there. Slide number 13. So are tech-savvy millennials natural multitaskers? Although there's no doubt they engage in multiple activities at one time, it's questionable whether this is good or bad. I've had some discussions with Dr. Robert Savoy, who's a well-regarded experimental psychologist and radiology instructor at Harvard Medical School, and he told me about his experience. He said that millennials are able to perform simplistic tasks somewhat simultaneously, but once complex decision-making comes into play, they require more concentration. For example, it's possible to walk and talk on a cell phone at the same time, but it's really not possible to effectively demonstrate a complex dance routine while talking on the phone. Slide number 14. So why does anecdotal evidence seem to indicate that something is different? Well, in my opinion, it results from all the tools available to high-tech millennials or tech-savvy millennials. In 2007, a study by Lax Misson and his colleagues from the University of Michigan showed that multitasking creates a higher memory load, which in turn contributes to medical error. And introducing technology to alleviate higher memory loads was suggested by these authors as a potential solution to kind of mitigate what's going on. In fact, that wasn't from the University of Michigan, excuse me. But by offloading short-term information to a computer, he found that emergency room doctors would be more able to manage decision-making. It seems that the tech-savvy millennials have stumbled onto the same solution in their own personal lives, and they use technology to be more efficient at a variety of tasks. MRI studies by Daniel Weissman, now this was from the University of Michigan, indicate that the brain has to process a single task at a time. Weissman found that the brain pauses, dumps previously collected information, and focuses on the current task, and then retrieves the dumped information to process again. So even though it seems like they're multitasking, they probably aren't. The phenomenon of what they're doing, though, does remind me of the 1970s and the 80s mainframe computers that use multitasking by virtue of time slicing. So I like to call what the tech-savvy millennials are doing is time slicing, using technology to kind of create the illusion of true multitasking taking place. Slide number 15. The tech-savvy millennials have begun to bring their toys into the classroom as tools. Currently, I experiment with allowing cell phones and smart devices in all my classes. I ask the students not to talk or socially network on personal matters, but to use the technology as an input device for notes or recording class information or for searching and filtering information. My goal is to begin instilling appropriate mobile technology behaviors because they're going to be using these devices in their professional careers. As a teacher, you know, should I or should we be alarmed about their desire to stay connected? Quite the opposite, I believe. I think that information used to be my private asset as a teacher, and that's no longer true. You know, I knew where the material was, how to get it, how to parcel it out, how to provide a fair and equitable exam that would motivate students to read, study, and hopefully learn. Now all that information is available to anyone that cares to use it. This is really a good thing if we think about it. It's just that we have to kind of consider it's really changed the rules of the road and how we want to do things in the classroom. You know, in addition to just mobile devices in the classroom, here's a few other things that I've seen students doing over the recent past few semesters. Slide 16. I've seen students doing digital video recording, and we've seen that before. In fact, I did cassette recordings when I was a student a long time ago. I've seen them do audio recordings. I've seen them use Twitter in class to text small messages about class content and notes about different things that are going on in class. Twitter can also give students the ability to organize and interact with their classmates, and they can share tweets among each other. They also have a historic record of their tweets on the web, and they can use this as a basis for studying. On slide 17, you'll see we have a few other things, social networking. I've seen students typing notes into Facebook and sharing those with their friends. They use smart mobile devices to talk to each other and to text each other. And then finally, I've even seen students do some live streaming with a technology called StickCam, where they've set a little webcam up and streamed out a lecture to some of their friends who weren't on campus that particular day. So a lot of things are happening with classroom tech if we allow our students to do those kinds of things. Slide 18. I've already kind of alluded to the massive change in the wear of technology use, and it kind of goes without saying that these mobile devices now are everywhere. Around university campuses, the patterns of student study groups who used to previously congregate in libraries and computer labs have been modified by a new geographic flexibility. There is a resurgence of students working on projects and working together on homework. They may not be physically with the people they're working with, however, and instead they actually may be physically with their friends, but working with others by using mobile devices, laptops, and other technology. Students want to still have close proximity, but they don't have to be in close proximity with the person they happen to be working with at that particular moment. That's kind of an interesting fact as well. Slide 19. Another amazing thing about the tech-savvy millennial is the creativity of their generation. Never before have so many tools been available for creating what's become really a tidal wave of new content. Young people from all over the world have invented imaginative and incredibly innovative digital artifacts, including poetry like Orkchek, art, prose, comic strips, videos, animations, all kinds of things. And you can find these all over the web. An example website that encourages this artistic expression that I find many students using right now is called DeviantArt. It has categories for all the traditional arts, painting, ceramics, literature, photography. Any kind of digital and non-digital art can be found out there. This gives them the ability to be inspired, to see what others are doing, and to come up with new ideas for the things that they personally want to create. Slide number 20. So how does this apply to higher ed in today's world? And this is really part two of my lecture. Most of us really aren't prepared to truly teach tech-savvy millennials on their own terms. After all, the world might be changing, but in general, facts are facts, and mastery of a subject is dependent on delivery method to some extent. Important material can still be presented in a way that makes it understandable, or it has to be, you know, presented in a way that makes it understandable. But we have to face the future and prepare our students for the world that they are going to face. In some ways, this is kind of difficult. And if we even look back only 5 years, you know, how many of us would anticipate the current pace of technology, the unexpected innovations, and the realities of today's interconnected world? For the moment, let's just wonder or consider a moment why today's learners need different methods of teaching. And several issues that we're going to deal with include this. First of all, we have to understand the changing priorities regarding what should be learned and what should be recognized as reference material. Secondly, we need to investigate teaching tools for filtering and accessing reliable information on an as-needed basis. Third, we kind of need to understand our students and understand they're truly different people shaped by their society, which is vastly different from what most of us experienced growing up. And it's not going to go back to the way it was, not now and not ever. And then we need to rethink educational delivery. We have to take our current system of higher ed back to the basics and rethink the way classes are kind of delivered. Slide 21. Perhaps we can only offer them the best tools and skills of our generation while encouraging them to change the world with the toys of their youth. We can kind of teach them as they teach us. You know, teachers, myself included in this, need to use our judgment to help our students understand our subject areas and understand why they have to take a path toward understanding certain material. But then we need to make sure we keep ourselves up to date with all the ways information is being shared, connected, and learned in their particular world. Slide 22. Here's an example of how today's tech-savvy millennials look at information. A few months ago, my oldest son, Mark, called me on the phone and said his medical school acceptance was going to be put on hold unless he produced his vaccination records by the next day. Now, that doesn't sound like a very difficult problem until time and geography constraints are thrown in. His records were located in a lockbox in Kansas. My wife and I were in Michigan, and we both had the two keys to the box. You know, I threw out some solutions. Maybe he could contact the family doctor to get his medical records, and we found they were off-site for digitizing and couldn't get to those. I thought about getting a crowbar for him to open it or getting the medical school to give him more time. My son, being a tech-savvy millennial, had other ideas. He went out to the Internet. He searched the web for finding information about picking locks, found a diagram that described the bends to put into a paperclip, and then he found a YouTube video that provided the mechanics about lock picking. Within a few minutes, he had this box open, and he had his medical records. And this wasn't just a cheap lockbox. It was a really good and well-made one. So he didn't know anything about lockpicking, but he had nowhere. He knew where to find the information. He tweeted out to his friends about his experience picking the lock, and soon he became a new node on their information networks. He's now the go-to guy for future lock picking needs. I hope medical school works out for him, because I hate to think where else that could lead to if it doesn't. So this is really a connectivist process in action. Learning resided in a community outside the individual, but was available to him when he required it. Slide 23. This brings up the concept of connectivism. And this comes from George Siemens in Canada, and he blogs about connectivism learning, connectivist learning, and he says it's really the application of network principles to define both knowledge and the process of learning. Knowledge is the pattern of relationships, and learning is the creation of new connections in this set of networks. So what can we do with this piece of information? Just another little story here. In 2003, my wife Annette and I and our three children accepted a one-year appointment on sabbatical at Auckland University of Technology. We settled into a nice condo overlooking the harbor on the north shore of Auckland in a little village called Devonport. We watched the America's Cup sailboats flash by from our living room windows, enjoyed the amenities of a beautiful country while being visited by a steady stream of family members and friends. Then things got a little strange, at least for me. I started to lose some weight and feel sick all the time. I became exhausted and was breaking out in skin rashes constantly. One night, I suddenly blew up like a balloon and started having breathing difficulties. My wife, Annette, rushed me to the hospital. Upon arrival, one of the nurses came in and told me I was in anaphylactic shock. The doctor who came in said we need to find out what triggered it. Eventually, after a progression of doctor visits, dietary restrictions, and so forth and so on, they discovered that I was allergic to a number of different foods, and he shortened the list for me to basically everything mammal. So you may be wondering, what's this got to do with education? Well, what I found out was, and switch to slide 25 now, I was forced from a diet of steak, chili, nachos, and so forth to something a little bit different. You know, did I have a choice on changing my diet? Of course. I could have chosen not to follow my doctor's advice, eat the same foods, and lived on a diet of EpiPens and medication to keep me from breaking out. Eventually, I'd waste away at an age probably much younger than if I'd taken care of myself and adapted to this new reality. So this is kind of where it applies to higher ed. Our educational institutions are now experiencing a bit of an anaphylactic reaction to old technologies, and we've decided, or we found, we have to change or suffer in some kind of slow agony here. I don't think that, you know, most of our institutions are in the emergency room or on life support at the moment, but here's some things that are worth kind of thinking about a little bit. And if we switch to slide 26 now, we can see that we're actually entering a new environment. We have to realize our current situation, and that's the tech-savvy millennials and the new technologies that are out there. We have to look at ways to cope. We have to look at how to substitute and then eventually re-engineer and continuously re-improve what we're doing with our classes and with our academic institutions. So if we kind of think about this a little bit, we have to go through these different stages and reassess where we're going with higher ed. If you switch over to slide 27, you'll see that we're looking at the reality of new media. With my food allergies, I could have dealt with this in a variety of different ways, and so too can higher ed deal with the reality of new media emerging from Web 2.0 technologies, mobile revolutions, and the integration of people into the internet's fabric. So there's different ways that various professors are kind of managing this, and there's different ways that tech-savvy millennials view their professors regarding their teaching practices. So if we switch over to slide 28, you can see we have example one here, Professor Luddite. His arrival to class is predictable because a small swarm of graduate assistants enter the room about 2 or 3 minutes prior to him to take attendance. Generally, his primary tool for course delivery, besides his voice, is a whiteboard, which he grudgingly accepted some years ago when the last chalkboard was removed from the building. On rare occasions, he's engaged a graduate assistant to project an overhead slide of a diagram onto a screen, but generally, he provides handouts instead. Professor Luddite wishes the internet was a fad, and he wishes it would fade into the mists of time. He has no intention of changing. He's always worked the way that he does and wouldn't consider doing anything any differently. Professor Luddite is coping with the new reality and biding his time until retirement. So in the food allergy analogy, this would be if I decided just to keep eating things I was allergic to and just hoping for the best. Slide 29, Professor Emulate. Professor Emulate is a professor in transition. She imagines her students are stunned to learn she's not more internet savvy, but she has little time to retool herself and fully integrate these new technologies into her classroom. She attends conferences and workshops where new technologies are lauded and terms like Diego, Coop, and Net Vibes are thrown around. Professor E, as her students call her, is well-liked and wants to move into the future, but is doing so carefully and slowly because her classes have always gotten good ratings and she wins teaching awards. She knows students are different than they used to be and are generally more receptive to the idea of using technology in a number of different ways. And she tries to learn a little bit more each semester, but is careful not to look dumb. And sometimes, over a glass of her favorite Pinot Noir, she wonders how far behind she is when it comes to all this internet stuff. In the food allergy world, this is substituting. So instead of me eating beef, I'm eating chicken. Instead of drinking milk, I'm drinking soy milk. So it's just kind of changing things out the best that we can, little by little. On slide 30, we move to Professor Digital. Professor Digital is a digital maven. He loves tinkering with applications and developing new exciting ways to introduce technologies to his students. He's a firm believer that change is constant, and being part of being a professor is to be on the forefront of new possibilities. He recently used new media literacy as a baseline for reevaluating his teaching and learning. He deconstructed his class and rebuilt it from the ground up. He wanted to take the strong collaborative possibilities he found in these new technologies and leverage them in his students' educational experiences. Professor Digital still lectures during class time because he believes in face-to-face interaction, but he's developed a learning community to help support his student learning. So Professor Digital is looking from a food allergy perspective at kind of reconstructing his diet from the ground up. Instead of trying to substitute things here and there, he tries to look at the picture holistically and come up with a solution that's going to consider the new reality and take the best of what's out there. There's also, on slide 31, one further person, and this is Professor Overenthusiastic. This kind of came about from one of the reviewers of my new Digital Shoreline book, and he was recounting some of the people he had encountered in the academic world. This is a person who is constantly trying out new technologies without really thinking about how they change or affect the pedagogy of his classes. In the academic world, this professor adopts every new technological innovation without considering its relevance to any pedagogical goals for the course. He or she confuses the students and often abandons specific tools midstream in favor of something new and different. Students dislike this uncertainty and no doubt start to wonder about the promise of Web 2.0 in higher ed. Slide 32. Young people are generally more adaptable than teachers, from what I've found. I think we can learn from the tech-savvy millennials, but they can learn a lot from us, too. I'm not saying that new technology should be used in all settings. In fact, just because these Web 2.0 tools are out there doesn't mean we have to use them or should use them in all classes. In fact, the smart use of new technology should result from the reformulation of our classes. Perhaps one of the worst approaches is to use these tools as a substitute for something that works well in its current form. Here's some additional ideas for exploring and settling on the new digital shoreline. Slide 33, socialization in the field of study. With the emergence of social interaction tools on the web, it only makes sense that research-oriented universities leverage collaboration to get more students involved in scientific research and studies. The opportunities there and can help bring a new sense of accomplishment and learning to the classroom. Artifacts from classroom learning and assignments can become persistent and useful to society, and our throwaway approach to doing classwork, grading it, and moving to the next semester can be altered to create more value from classroom experience. Number two, help enable new media literacy. Educators should look for opportunities to incorporate new media into their classes and promote its use. After all, students use these tools and other ones like them in both their future careers and in their personal lives. Number three, help create sticky learning experiences. I think that educators have the opportunity to create an even better and stickier educational experience by adding lifelong learning partnerships to our students' university experiences. This means allowing our students to return to the classroom as participants, teachers, and learners throughout their lives. And fourth, putting play to work. The tech-savvy millennials have spent their formative years observing a different world, a world of unlimited choice and digital abundance. And we need to help them guide putting this play to work in the correct kind of ways. Slide 34, a couple more items here. Promoting self-learning and learning to learn. We want to enable self-learning and self-training on new technologies. Students don't need step-by-step instructions from educators or in the classroom. they need to have nowhere so they can find the abundant information on the web and self-train in many different kinds of ways. We also want to prepare our students for ubiquitous learning. They live in a world with abundant information, with podcasts, videos, tutorials, high-quality research papers, lots of scientific facts and theory. All this stuff is out there. We just have to help them learn what is good and what is not good, what is accurate information and what should be discarded and filtered out. We also want to help them understand how boundaries have been redefined. You know, in today's world, instructors can work 24/7, as you know, and never feel finished. We need to plan for balance and help our students learn how to balance their schedules, their interaction with technology, and come up with a time frame and a time schedule that works for family, friends, hobbies, and exercise. In the long run, a balanced life is going to be more productive and better for their careers, and we have to kind of help them understand how to turn off continuous partial attention at the correct moments. Then finally, engaging real problems. Our students want to make a difference, and if provided with real-world problems to solve, they're going to become more engaged and more willing to put forth their best efforts. I find that our students really become engaged when they know that what they create is going to be posted on the web or is going to be used to create an informational node that others are going to access and look at and use for real-world problems. So remember, using new technologies like web conferencing, collaborative authoring tools is going to create new deliverables in this environment that they live in. Real-world experts can be engaged and added to the mix to work with our students in this situation.
I'd like to interrupt so that we can explain how people can ask questions. Operator, could you please explain?
Thank you. If you have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
Also, if you would like to ask a question but don't want your name or institution identified, you may email it to me at info@insidehighered.com, and I will read it without identifying you. Roger, back to you to wrap up.
All right. Thank you, Scott. I'm starting to lose my voice a little bit, but we're moving to slide 35. Today's tech-savvy millennials view the world much differently than previous generations. Digitally enabled youth spend their time seeking relevant content. They use social networks, online recommendations, and search engines to explore their world of multiple choices and customize their surroundings to form an information-based identity. For teachers, knowing how to encourage these behaviors in smart ways creates a huge challenge. The world that lies ahead is one of nearly limitless access to information, availability to everybody, creation by everybody, and information belonging to everybody. Facts, solution, and data are going to be available whenever and wherever a person wants, on mobile devices and anywhere they happen to be. The world will become one of niche jobs, niche skills, and new areas we can't even begin to guess at right now. It's our job as teachers to take these enormous opportunities and help focus these new possibilities in ways that are just beginning to emerge. And I really shouldn't just limit that to teachers. That really goes out to all aspects of higher ed, all administrators, all teachers, everybody that's working to help shape the next generation of students and people that are out there. Slide 36. If you want more information about what I'm talking about, and you'll see there's a great deal more information about these topics that I wasn't able to get to in this short half hour of time, you can access it through the New Digital Shoreline, which is published by Stylus Publishing. It's also available at Amazon.com. And additionally, I also keep a blog in. This is a relatively new blog, but it's out at www.mckaney.com, and you'll see I'm regularly going to be posting information about this particular topic, the New Digital Shoreline, and how millennials and technology are impacting higher ed. So feel free to take a look at that sometime if you get a chance.
Thanks very much, Roger, for that overview. I want to turn to Q&A, and I've gotten several questions in by email, and I have one that I'm going to actually start with. But before I do that, operator, could you again explain how people may ask questions if they want to use the system?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question or on the phone, please press star, then one.
And if you want to send them in by email, info@insidehighered.com. I want to start with a question of my own, Roger. You were talking about how you ask your students to only use the devices in class for note-taking or activities related to your class. Hear constant frustration from faculty members about students who Facebook or socialize or web browse. We even wrote a story about a professor who has a rule that if he catches anyone, he walks out of class and just leaves the whole class untaught that day. What do you advise to faculty members who are frustrated by use of devices in class for non-educational purposes?
Well, that's a great question. There's really, I mean, there are two approaches. You can take the hard line and say no, or you can take, and this is from the Buddha, he says, turn aside. I kind of look at it as something I cannot control. I discovered this because even when you say don't use mobile devices in class, there is somebody with their hand in their pocket that is texting, and you can't stop that. So I think my opinion is that we want to encourage them to kind of think of it as a professional tool. Think of what they're going to be doing with these devices when they get out of school. You're going to get students that are not going to use them in the way you hope, but you just hope the message gets across in some extent. I mean, people draw cartoons on their notepads when they're taking notes in class. They're going to do what they're going to do, but by even getting a small bit of functionality into their mobile devices during class time, I think we're preparing them for the world they're about to step into. So I think we have to face the fact that these mobile devices are almost like personal extensions to who they are and what they do. And that's not going to change. It's only going to become more and more intense and more expected as time goes on.
Okay, I'm going to read a question via email. My college is considering giving all students an iPad in certain programs. Do you advocate such programs to customize the devices being used by all students in a program?
My personal opinion is I would love to have the ability to do that. A lot of things that I would like to do in class, I can't, because at a state university, we cannot ensure that every person has access to the same level of technology. If you kind of make the playing field level with those kinds of devices, it will open up a whole new door of opportunities, a whole new set of possibilities of things you can do in class. Just considering the amount of social networking, the amount of information exchange, the different kinds of things you can do if everyone has access to a technology platform that the teacher can predict and understand, it's really mind-boggling. I think that's a great thing to do, and it would really move your institution in the correct direction.
Another question in via email. Can you discuss how these techniques can impact retention?
Yeah, I think one of the retention studies I looked at shows that just personal contact is a huge factor. And I know my own daughter being recruited by different universities right now, it really makes a big impression on her when someone contacts her specifically with a little bit of a personal touch. By having social networking and social media out there, it allows universities to have more of a personalized touch. If you think about the tech-savvy millennials, they live in a world where mass customization is the norm. So everything is personalized. They set up their own pages on Facebook the way they want them to look. They're used to having the ability to kind of control certain aspects of their environment. And by having social media and other types of contact, I think students will feel more connected, more part of things. I know that just sending students messages by Twitter seems to keep them coming to class more and seems to remind them how to prepare for exams, how to do different things. And just kind of, we have to think of it. Sometimes a lot of these people are young. They don't think about everything that we would think about, in our adult minds. And so just little reminders, little hints here and there go a long way for them.
Another question, what is the college's responsibility to teach students about the privacy issues raised by their online lives?
I think that the universities do have the responsibility of providing that as part of the information that we give to our students. I mean, I can see a day when their admissions package will include privacy information. I mean, right now, if you think about it, I recently went to an iPad seminar. In fact, it was yesterday, where they talked about how people can grab your passwords and logins, on secured networks, and they gave us information about using a VPN connection on campus so students and others who wanted to get our passwords could. Things like that students don't think about. They're just able to use these devices. They buy a mobile phone, and they immediately start using it. They don't consider what's going on behind the scenes. So, instead of having them do as much memorization work, perhaps some of the time we spent doing that before could be spent giving them further education on concerns like privacy, how to ensure that their identity is not going to be leaked out, how to ensure that they're setting up good passwords and they're not opening themselves up for future problems. So along with that, you know, credit card use, responsible credit card use, is kind of in the same category as that family of facts, in my opinion.
I've got two questions here about Facebook and college access to it. One is asking whether you advocate admissions, or what you think of admissions officers who view applicants' Facebook pages. And the other is asking what you think of policies about whether or not faculty members should friend their students.
Those are tough questions. Personally, I do not friend students in Facebook unless it's someone that I know from outside of the university or something. I think that most students, from my interactions and my surveys I've done, do not want faculty members on their Facebooks. They kind of view that as their own personal world, and they don't want us intruding on that too much. That being said, there's probably exceptions to that. I think that what I typically do is I encourage my students to use an alternate social network. I favor LinkedIn, which is a professional network, and it's kind of oriented toward the business world. And I encourage them to form a professional network starting when they're in the university, using LinkedIn and then using Facebook for their personal network of friends. As far as viewing student Facebooks go, I don't believe that that's something that I want to do. I don't think it's a good idea for us to go out and look at our students' Facebooks. I mean, I've seen a number of Facebooks and friends of my children's Facebooks, I guess you would say, and I know a lot of times things get put out there, they're exaggerated, twisted, or been put out there as a joke. Just to give you an example, my daughter put on her Facebook one day that she was married to another high school student who was a female in her class, and a day after that I got a call from several people about my daughter getting married to a girl, and you know, and we hadn't invited her to the wedding, and what did we think of this? So it was this big scandal. And I could not believe that just by goofing around on her Facebook that she got listed this response from different people. So I don't think that everything you read on Facebook is true, and I think that you have to be careful if you're basing decisions on what students are doing when they're goofing around and having fun.
Here's a question from a community college listener. What advice do you have for community college faculty members who have these digitally savvy students and also older, non-traditional students in the same classroom?
Yeah, that is actually a particular interest to me because I do encounter that here as well. I have a number of non-traditional students in the classroom. What I try to do is, in some cases, I've actually set them up with mentors, technology mentors in class, which seems to work okay. Most of the students who are returning students or non-traditional students that feel technologically behind the times want somebody to help them, but they're embarrassed to ask for that help. So I like to do a little survey before the class starts to find out what different people's levels are. And then when I create team projects or group assignments, I try to kind of divide things up to create a nice balance. Sometimes I will specifically, after talking to a student, help them find someone in class who can help them with different things. What I find is that most people are at university to learn. They want to find out about these technologies, and sometimes they're too shy to ask or too embarrassed because they feel that they should know. A lot of times if I notice I have a number of non-traditional students, I may have a special class session where I go through some technologies and make that an optional attendance, and then they can come, and some of the ones who already know about it may not show up, and you know, it just makes it a little bit easier on them. But there's a number of different ways to handle it. But keep in mind, they're here at the university to learn, and if it's technology that they're lacking, then we have to find ways to help them learn that, too. So,
Here's a question. How can colleges use students' use of digital technologies to get better information about their students and what their needs are?
How can they use digital technology?
I think the question is getting at sort of, with all the student activity online, how can colleges use that information, or should they?
Right.
Should
so,
they?
So it'd be kind of data mining.
Yeah.
One of the ways that I've been kind of considering or using some of the digital information is if you look at the, if you want to call it click streams on your online course management systems, you can kind of see what files students are using a lot and what files they're not using very much. You can kind of use different statistics about use and about how long they spend on different pages and so forth, and I'm not sure what kind of LMS you might have, but that's one way to gather information is by looking at where they seem to go when they're online, on your material and what they seem to use and what they don't seem to use. Another thing that I use to help gather information about students is I use wikis, and I post exam review notes out there, and then I invite the entire class to flesh out the notes. So I give them topics, and I give them a set of points for contributing to fleshing out those topics. And by looking at what they write, I'm able to really discern what in class they did not understand collectively speaking. If I look at a wiki and I find out that one of the study topics I put down is not being filled out or developed very well on the wiki, then I know I probably didn't do a good job of teaching that particular topic. So I go back and maybe remove that item from the test and kind of take another stab at it in future lectures. So there's different ways that we can use information kind of covertly but ethically to kind of help our students learn and understand what they may know and may not know. I'm not really a big advocate of using, like I said, going out to their Facebooks or trying to see what they're up to in their personal lives or anything like that, but I do think it's interesting to see, as far as educationally experiences go, or what they may or may not understand.
Here's another question. Do you think that students' use of the web is encouraging plagiarism?
I think that it's easy to plagiarize. I don't think that they go out with the intention of, I'm going to steal someone else's work and call it my own. I think what ends up happening is they kind of get overwhelmed or get into a situation where they've got a time constraint and they suddenly make a bad choice, and that is to copy something and paste it into a document. What I have started doing in my courses, and I've had a number of cases where I've had to confront students and take them to the academic integrity situation over plagiarism, I try to preempt it now. What I do is I show them ways of going out to different websites where there's valuable information, copy that information, paste it into a Word document, or use a tool that creates citations when you copy and paste it from a website. Show them what the appropriate amount of information to copy and paste into a document is, how to edit that. And if they do copy something from another source, I usually ask them to change the text color to, say, red or blue in their draft document, so later on they don't accidentally forget that they copied and pasted that from somewhere. Some students actually, I think, you know, they do some research, and then 3 weeks later they come back and write or create the final draft, and that in between there somehow they sort of forget, maybe conveniently sometimes, that this information was grabbed somewhere and stuck into a document. But if you get into a habit of always changing the color of something that isn't your work, and you know, using a set of good rules that ensure it's not plagiarism and ensure that you're writing things in your own words, then you can kind of eliminate a lot of the plagiarism problems. I also think along with this Creative Commons work that is legal to recreate and reproduce and reuse and remix and so forth is important in their world. And we have to kind of show them how to understand the copyrights and how to understand what is legal to copy and understand how to cite that back. And sometimes I have them do an assignment where it is a complete document of remixed and remashed material that's not original content of theirs. And then I have another assignment that they do where they might have to create their own unique material. And that kind of helps illustrate the difference between legal copying on the web and reuse and developing your own unique material. So there's just a lot more complexity than there used to be with this kind of stuff.
And then the last question I have, also via email, what do you suggest to do with the Luddite professors?
That's a good question. And I know several of them. I know one that won't even go into his email. He has this grad student print it out for him every day. So I don't know if there's much we can do. I think we can encourage them, and we can help them see the benefit of using some things. But really, you know, it's kind of like the old adage, you can lead the horse to water, but you can't make them drink them. This situation is that they can decide what they want to do in their world, and they're probably going to do that. We can help try to educate them and help them understand what they're missing out on, but many of them are not going to change. And I wish I had a magic solution for that. I think baby steps is another approach. Some of them are perhaps used to being experts their entire life in their field, and they're very good at, and they know extremely valuable information, and they know a lot. but they don't like feeling that they're behind or that they're not the expert. And sometimes when they come into these new media areas, then that's where they sort of fall into that category. So it makes it a little bit tough if you're dealing with egos and other things.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank our listeners today, and we'll be sending you an evaluation on today's audio conference and also invite your suggestions on future audio conferences. And thank you very much, Roger, for sharing your expertise today. Everybody, have a good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may all disconnect. Everyone have a great day.